It's not clear to me that we have a left, in the sense of an organized left. We certainly have large numbers of individuals. We do not have any large national organizations of the left that most of us are willing to join. We don't have an anti-war movement, despite the succession of wars. International Answer continues to hold demonstrations, but they have no capacity to be the center of an actual anti-war movement. We have a few conferences like this one. We have a few journals. We have a set of, we have Pacifica, a set of left-wing radio stations. But all of that is really small. We have the odd situation in which there really are, there is a large sector of the population that I would say qualifies as the left, but you can't organize them. You can get thousands of people to come to a conference like this, but suggesting that people should join an organization tends to fall on deaf ears. I think that that's partly because of work patterns. I think people are very leery about commitments to anything beyond next week. But I also think it's for the other reasons that I'm going to talk about that we don't really have a clear direction for the left. The last thing I would say is that I think it's obvious to all of us that the left, meaning that collection of individuals, is demographically lopsided. That means that it tends to be white, it tends to be of the professional class, it tends to be old, you just look around. There is also a youth movement, but compared to the youth movement of the 60s, that youth movement is small, and at this point, I would say it lacks a clear focus. It had a clear focus in Seattle. It was very important in the anti-war movement when that movement was strong. At this point, I think it doesn't really know where it's going, and of course, we are in no better shape. So that's what we're dealing with. So in that context, it's hard to even talk about internal problems because the question is internal to what? But I do want to list some problems that I think have contributed to getting us to this point. The first is a widespread attitude that organizations and more broadly unity are oppressive and should be avoided. This comes in part out of a set of legitimate attitudes, a critique of particularly organizations of the old left as rigid and hierarchical and dominated by white men. But I think that that critique has been overdone to the point where it's a matter of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Instead of improving the organizations, you get rid of them. You turn against organizations generally. The second is that, and I would add to that, that I think if you don't have organizations and if you don't have a concept of at least struggling for unity, not automatic unity, but trying to achieve it, you don't have a left. Second thing is, I would say that the left in the United States over the last several decades has been predominantly cultural in its orientation. And what that means is that we tend to focus on changing people's attitudes and especially changing people's language. And that means we tend to focus on ourselves and those on our periphery. Now, not that that's not important, but that's a different task than challenging institutions. And I think the approach of the left towards racism is a case in point here, that that approach has been largely cultural. And the problem with having a largely cultural approach to racism is that means you're not building unity around challenging the institutions of racism. And that's what would be the basis for an actual unified movement. Third thing I want to say is I think there are conceptions of radicalism that run around the movement, whatever that movement is, that are problematic. The first is, I think one we inherit from the 60s is the idea that radicalism consists of expressing one's feelings, one's horror at racism, sexism, war, and so forth, without thinking about how our actions are directed towards particular objectives. A second, and I would say worse version of this, is a conception of radicalism as striking a pose. The way you know you're a radical is you make radical statements, and you hope to make more radical statements than the next person. And another related conception of radicalism is that radicalism consists of exaggerating everything so as to wake people up. So that means conspiracy theories. It means talking about saying fascism is not only close, it has arrived. We live in a fascist state, and so forth, with the idea that somehow by that kind of language you can create a left movement. I don't think it works. Well, I think what all of this means is that we have forgotten about two things. One of them is organization, and the other one is strategy. And I would say that at this point, we don't even have a vocabulary for talking about strategy. I have less to say about that than I have to say about the other questions, because I think it has been so forgotten. And without organizations, there's very little basis for debating strategy. Okay, so if I have a few more minutes, what I want to do is tell you about the movement on the California campuses, which I think is very encouraging. My own perspective is from UC Santa Cruz, where I'm part of a faculty organizing committee. I've also been the link between the UC Santa Cruz faculty committee and the UC Berkeley faculty committee, so I have some idea of what's going on both campuses. I would say all of this is too schematic to fit the reality. But I would say, well, first of all, I would say that there have been two high points so far. The first high point was September 24th, when there was a call for a faculty student walkout throughout the UC system. And it was actually a lot more successful than we expected, because the Regents chose that moment to announce an enormous hike in student fees. And so that meant the students got really involved, and therefore, you know, we had a big movement. Second was recently, March 4th. A statewide protest was called on March 4th, and it did happen, not only on UC campuses, but the state campuses, community colleges, and also in communities that those campuses are part of. I have seen what I would call three sectors of the movement, even though they're not clearly delineated. In the early stages of the movement, at both UCSC and at Berkeley, there were a small group of students who tend to refer to themselves as insurrectionists or sometimes situationists. Their view was that this was a revolutionary struggle, and that capitalism was on the verge of collapse, and all you had to do was shove it a little bit, and we would have a revolution. And they wanted, their strategy was occupations, not just under certain circumstances, but occupation as a standard tactic. Problem with this was that while there were a lot of students who engaged in occupations at first, skepticism rose, partly because it became clear that you can't build a mass movement just on the basis of occupations, you know, for which people are likely to be thrown out of school. So a second sector within the movement became more influential, and this is a sector that calls itself anarchist, because there are large numbers of anarchists in it, though there are also students who would not call themselves anarchists. They were interested and are interested in building a mass movement. And they, at UC Santa Cruz, they were responsible for organizing the student-faculty strike that took place on March 4th and that closed the campus down. My perception was that there was a lot of student support, at least for their aims, and a kind of agnostic attitude towards the tactic of closing the campus down. People were willing to go along with it, but, you know, not mass enthusiasm for that tactic. That was my perception. Now, there's a third category of the movement that I happened to be involved in organizing buses to go to Sacramento, where a rally was planned that would represent all of the campuses and all of the levels of public education, including K through 12. I was the co-MC of that rally, which gave me a good view of what was going on there. And there were, I would say, about 2,500 people there, mostly students from pretty much all of the campuses on all three levels in Northern California. And what was striking about it was the very high percentage of students of color, and especially Latinos. At one point, one speaker started out in English, he switched into Spanish. It was clear that a very large percentage of the audience understood what he was saying and appreciated the fact that he was speaking Spanish. Several students spoke. What they said was that they are thrilled to find themselves as college students. They are determined to graduate, and they're not going to let anybody take that away from them. And they are determined to maintain access for other members of their communities. So it was a very different kind of rhetoric that you get on the UCSC campus. Nothing about revolution, all about defending the right to education for working class students. And that's what's interesting about this movement. Unlike the movements of the 60s, I was on the Berkeley campus in the 60s. It was an overwhelmingly white middle class to upper middle class student body. The student body is now different. There are a lot more students of color, especially if you consider all levels of higher education, and a lot more working class students. The point I want to make about this, if I have 1 minute left, is that if you think about the contrast between, people talk about what's more radical and less radical, those comparisons tend to be about the tactics that people are willing to use. The students of color, there was a certain tension over this, certain criticism of me for being involved in sending students to Sacramento, because some of the more radical students wanted everybody on hand shutting down the campus. But a lot of the students of color, while utterly opposed to the cuts, were not willing to participate in that tactic. I think partly because of the occupations, which they didn't want to participate in. And I think what's striking about this is there's a lot of talk about tactics in terms of who's radical and who's not radical. There's much less talk about strategy. I think that this movement, I happen to think that the student of color sector of the movement is less likely to evaporate than the rest of the movement, partly because of their very clear interest in their issues, but also partly because they have ongoing organizations, whereas the organizations being formed by the anarchist wing of the movement, the General Assemblies, I think could be a bit ephemeral. But I also think that the movement as a whole needs a strategy, because the danger is we won't get anywhere and people will get discouraged. My own view is that part of that strategy has to be changing the laws in California, getting rid of the two-thirds rule, and also increasing taxes, especially for the corporations and the rich. I think we need to bring back the slogan of tax the rich.
Thank you, Barbara. Now we're going to shift gears slightly into a more loosely oriented dialogue between Barbara, based around her presentation, and Bill Fletcher here, who is editor of Black Commentator and co-author of Solidarity Divided, and Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine and ZNet. We'll do that for a few minutes, about 5 minutes, and then move on to Bill's presentation before we repeat that process again and move on to Michael. I'll grab you can use that mic, yeah, okay. I'll grab the third mic too.
Okay, thank you, good morning. Slight correction, I stepped down as executive editor of Black Commentator, but I'm still a columnist. Very briefly, I agreed with overwhelmingly with what Barbara was laying out. One difference that I want to raise, one difference and then one elaboration, really. I actually think that the left is very diverse, but there is multiple lefts. In 1998, we had the Black Radical Congress conference in Chicago. There were 3,000 people there. And these were people that overwhelmingly identified as radical, if not, or left. But those people, by and large, are not here. They're not in this gathering today with us. Some people that were associated with that are, but it wasn't overwhelming. I think that we around the same time, saw an effort to start something called the New Raza Left among Chicanos. There was something called the Asian Left Forum. So there were a number of efforts, and there were efforts in labor as well. So I actually think that the left in the United States is actually very diverse, but it doesn't see itself as a left. It is very segmented. And that becomes a problem, and it's related in some ways to what I want to get to, which I can't talk about because I only have a minute. But we have to reconceptualize on a very fundamental level. Barbara was talking about strategy. I agree. We also need a narrative. And I don't have time to elaborate on this, but I just want to suggest Gramsci talked about the notion of the modern prince in his prison writings as a way of describing the role of a party and the role of a party in the process of leading a historic bloc in Italy of the working class and the peasants of the South in the struggle for socialism. I think we need here something I'm calling the Tecumseh paradigm, which basically is a way of rethinking the role and the task of the left and the kind of bloc that we need to be building. Because what Tecumseh, a great Shawnee leader in the early 19th century, recognized was that the Native Americans as individual tribes could not defeat the invaders, nor could they defeat the invaders on the basis of a confederation. They had to reconceptualize who they were and, in fact, move to build a nation state to oppose the invaders. He didn't succeed. But that basic conception seemed to me was the right one. And the failure of that conception to work, for reasons that we can't get into right now, I think set in motion a series of things that led to the ultimate defeat of Native Americans. We have to reconceptualize the relationship of various struggles, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Am I supposed to respond?
Do you want to wait till after Michael does, or do you want to respond right now to Bill and Michael?
Well, basically, I would say I appreciate both points. You know, first of all, I do think that the way in which the left is divided up now makes it difficult to see all of it. And so the part of it that I tend to see is this left. And I completely agree with what Bill said about the need for coalition, unity, whatever you want to call it. I have a question for him. Is that appropriate at this point?
We have to keep it within a minute, the question.
Okay.
So if you want to Michael's response, then your response.
Yeah, okay. Would you see that as specifically socialist, or would you see it as more broadly critical of capitalism and open to socialism as a unity in which socialists would play a part but would not be everybody?
I think that at this point it needs to be anti-capitalist, but that we need. But as a socialist, I don't think that there is a solution other than socialism, and I think that socialists need to engage with non-socialist, anti-capitalist around things. But there needs to be a broad anti-capitalist unity. But right now, there's, and this is what I was trying to raise last night. There's even a level of unity with progressives who are not at this point prepared to openly challenge capitalism because one of our tasks is to defeat right-wing populism and to open up, you know, to continue and deepen an anti-corporate challenge. So I think we have to operate multidimensionally.
How many of you watch or see or have ever seen American Idol on TV? Hands up. Some. You haven't? It's too bad. They have a evaluative team, and they evaluate the singer and stuff. And so, most of the time, they trash and they're hostile. And every once in a while, they really like it. I loved it. That's what they do. They might get up and hug you, but I won't go that far. But really, I think one of the problems with our movement, this is going to sound a bit odd, but one of our problems with the movement is that most people in the movement hearing your speech would say, that's not theory. That's not, because it isn't, you know, abstract words and everything else. And of course, the reaction should be the exact opposite. This person is thinking, and most of them aren't. And that's another problem. I'd quibble about the Soviet Union, because it seems to me that the fall of the Soviet Union was one down, one to go. And that it was doing as much harm to the idea of an alternative vision existing as it did by not existing. So a little quibble. But the idea that the main obstacle is hopelessness, I'm going to talk about that. The idea that a big problem is no large organizations, that's the main thing. You know, I just agree. But there is this issue about where the population is at. And I'm not sure I understand what either of you are saying. And what I'm saying is so weird on that point. But I honestly think that most of the population of the United States knows everything is broken. That most of what we tell people at a deep level, they all know. If you watch popular culture, if you look at movies, if you read the novels that are number one on the bestseller list, they are full of behavior that goes beyond what we say about what's wrong with capitalism. You know, pharmaceutical companies that kill tons of people, just example after example. And the people who read it and who view it don't think about that. That's a lie. That's an exaggeration. Instead, they think Bush knocked down the Twin Towers, 40% of them. So in other words, I think I'm agreeing with you about this, that they're anti-system. Mm-hmm. They are so ready to be for something, and we offer very little. And the right wing offers a lot. Rush Limbaugh does a better job of talking to them than we do. That's hard to hear and sad, but I think true. And they're angry. And they're rightfully angry. So I agree. I just think that the part of the job that we keep trying to do, explain to people that war kills, capitalism hurts, sexism is brutal, racism is undignified, and everybody knows. And the part that we don't do, dealing with the hopelessness, dealing with the idea of getting someplace, is what's needed to get anyplace.
Okay, I want to make two comments. Again, I agree with everything that Michael says.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem on this panel. But I do want to add that as I was going through what I see as the problems... As I was going through what I see as the main problems on the left, what I was actually thinking, but I didn't want to beat a dead horse, was that... the postmodernist left has played a major role in all three of them. You know, there has been a several decade long campaign on the part of what we call the academic left, which is not all academic leftists, against unity, against organization, for a cultural conception of politics as opposed to political or institutional, and absolutely against a broad analysis and against strategy. And I think that all of that is a recipe for a weak, fragmented left, and ultimately no left at all. And you know, I mean, I talk about this to the point where people get tired of hearing what I have to say about it, but I think it's important.
Okay, thank you. Now we'll transition back to Bill for his main presentation on race and socialist strategy.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon again. I wrote a piece for ZNet, was posted June 11th, 2009, called Race, the National Question, Empire and Socialist Strategy in the U.S. And originally what I was going to do was to summarize that for this afternoon, but I'm not going to do that. I want to actually segue from what Barbara was laying out, because I think that in order to understand the problems of the U.S. left, you have to understand race, settlerism, and empire. And one of the difficulties in the U.S. left is that there is a tendency to believe in something that I call economic inoculation. And if you think about this as analogous to a polio vaccination, you know, you have the kids born, you give them an inoculation so that they don't get polio. Much of the US left believes that if you inoculate people with enough information, particularly white people, enough information about the economy, and this relates actually to what Michael was raising, and that's partly why I wanted to surface this. If you give them enough information about how screwed up the system is, how they're losing out compared to the rich, the polarization of wealth, et cetera, that they will come to the conclusion that something else is necessary. And I would suggest to you that that fundamentally is wrong. Because we live in a very strange social formation where there's the confluence of race, settlerism, and empire. So we have this social construction of race begun in the 1600s, actually begun in the 1500s in Ireland, but begun in the 1600s here, that was both a matter of social control over a very diverse population, but aimed at justifying colonial oppression and exploitation. This matched with settlerism, and particularly the idea in all settler states of the removal of the indigenous population, either their annihilation or their physical removal, whether you're talking about Native Americans here, the indigenous in Australia, the Palestinians, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea of the preference for the settler, and that the rules of the game always must be set in ways that guarantee that the settler wins. So in that sense, treaties are irrelevant, except in insofar as they are to the advantage of the settler. And the issue of empire, U.S. Global hegemony, and the idea that the U.S. dominates, so that what we have in the United States is the ability for people in the United States to ignore the global situation precisely because we live in the heart of an empire. We can sit back and ignore the fact that the U.S. supported the annihilation of 500,000 to 3 million Indonesians in 1965. We can just do it. We can maybe shed a tear, maybe ignore it, maybe plead guilt, ignorance, but basically think that it's okay to be ignorant of this. It's okay to have not known this. It's okay not to do anything. And so part of the challenge that we have is in terms of building a left is to understand that in its very conception, it's gotta be global. And it's gotta be global not in a sense of setting up one more, liberation support project or, workers of the world support project. It means that in both our educational effort as well as the campaigns that we're taking up, that we're constantly thinking about the interconnection of these different issues, the global, the issue of race, an issue of settlerism. One of the things, for example, that we have to understand is that part of the reason for the extremely strong pro-Israeli sentiment in the United States is that Israel's us. I mean, it really is. That the entire ethos that surrounds the creation of Israel is that which surrounds the formation of the United States, including the quasi-religious myths, the notion that there was really no one here, but except the settler landed. God, it's really interesting, this is somewhat of a tangent. God always enters into the picture when it comes to settlerism. And it's sort of funny, it's like there's a telephone call between God and the settler, and somehow the indigenous are left out of the equation. There's not a party line or something, they're not connected in. They don't get the message from God. The settler always gets the message from God, and the message is always the same. God says to the settler, this is your land. There's really no one here. Go forth, multiply, do what you want with it. And, it's like tough for the people that are there, right? And here in the United States, that settler mentality is so woven into the basic narrative of the United States that we're obviously going to support Israel because it's the same basic narrative. Now, the way that this partly relates to strategy is the issue of right-wing populism. And this is where I want to pick up on something that Michael was saying, that it is absolutely the case that people realize something is broken. They do. People aren't stupid. But why is it that Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck appeal to people? It's not simply that they have the airwaves and we don't. I wish it was that easy, because then I'd have a pretty good solution, right? I'm not going to say it publicly, but there'd be a pretty good solution in terms of how to deal with that. The problem is that the narrative of the right-wing populace corresponds to the myth of U.S. history. Our narrative doesn't. You see, when we start talking about race and settlerism and empire, that's not part of the myth of U.S. history. That's what makes our job so much more difficult, because we are constrained by the truth. And we actually have to speak with people about what the real history was, which is not simply about trashing the U.S. It's about a very dynamic, fascinating history of struggle, but it's also a history of crimes and atrocities. And so what the right-wing populace can do is that they have a narrative that basically says, we were brought up, we meaning white people, of course, but we're more enlightened, so we don't say white people. So we as white people were brought up with the basic notion that we work hard and we're guaranteed a good future, and so are our children. But now things are collapsing, and the question is, why are things collapsing? We, meaning again white people, have been betrayed. This corresponds to what people want to hear, many people want to hear. Again, that is what makes our job very difficult. We are not going to be able to combat that with 2-3 many Amy Goodmans, right? And I love Amy Goodman. And I think the world of Juan Gonzalez. I love the Pacifica Network. You know, I think Bill Moyers is incredible. But that's not enough. This is where the question of organization and strategy enter in. Because without organization, we're unable to build the cascade that needs to be built in order to win. Without organization, what happens is we have isolated struggles like the Republic Workers occupation in Chicago that millions of people supported but were not willing to replicate. It's not because people lack courage. There needs to be a left that takes those lessons, repeats them, turns them into a new narrative, turns them into a strategy that shows that it's not simply the courage of the UE workers, it's something that can be done in other places, right? We need a left that articulates a narrative that really interrogates U.S. history and offers a different kind of interpretation as to what's happened and what needs to happen, that really challenges us on some of these settler assumptions, that really goes beyond the issue of race as in a matter of consciousness, as a matter of morality, and talks about the continuing issue of the racial differentials that exist in the real world that divide our populations. This is where the issue of the left must come in. And this won't happen through these conferences. These conferences are wonderful. I want to see them continue. But the messages that come from these conferences have to be translated again into issues of program and issues of mobilization, which takes us full circle back to what Barbara was raising. And that's where I'm going to wrap up.
Thank you, Bill. So now, again, we'll have an interaction between the other panelists and Bill, starting this time with Michael.
So again, the gigantic clash of debate is absent. the idea that enough critique will generate leftism, it's not confined to, I often have this argument with Noam, with Chomsky, saying to him basically, you know, you pile it on, and you pile it on, and you pile it on, and what's the result of that? And back when I was having this conversation with him, I said the result of that is either that after a while the person is comatose and cynical, or a weatherman, and neither one is doing us much good. It turns out it's not true with Noam. I know that from talking to countless people who he influences, but it is true for the left. It produces that. So I agree with you mightily, but I'm not sure what the reason for that is, because I don't think it's unique to the United States. That's where everything that you said made a lot of sense to me, and I go with it, but this is no different anyplace else. I mean, it isn't as if you could pile on those facts, not just in, say, Europe, but in any third world country. And there isn't even any facts to pile on, because they see it every single day. Yeah. So I'm not convinced that it explains it. It's just part of it in our country. I think what explains it is, like you used the word courage, and people used to think, well, it's because people aren't courageous. Well, you watch people running up the stairs to rescue people on 9/11 in the buildings. People are courageous. Just put it aside. But people aren't courageous for something that they think is a waste of time. That's the point. And if we are saying to them to do something which they feel is simply hopeless or stupid, one or the other, either one does it, they're not going to relate. And when we communicate in ways that don't communicate, and when we say things that make no sense, and when et cetera, et cetera. So I would, last point is, I think that sadly, I listen to Limbaugh, and of course, I mean, he lies. He makes stuff up, but he spins out a tale which I think makes sense to people, not just in the way that you describe, but right now as an explanation of what's going on and what could be done about it to change it. And of course, it's not going to work, but they hear it as rational. They hear us as crazy. And that's a problem, or that's what I think.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say something that's sort of similar to what Michael just said, though from a different angle. I think what Bill has described is a set of constant, it's the framework for, you know, it's a set of constant obstacles to the development of a left in the United States. The question for me, though, is why do we manage to develop a mass left at some moments and not others? Mm. In the 1960s, the left had momentum. You know, it was a movement that huge numbers of people were willing to abandon good jobs, drop out of school to join. People felt that if you weren't there, you were really missing something. The left, the right at that time did not have that. They did not have momentum. They were sitting in the background. So the question for me is, how has that reversed? Now, I don't think I have the whole answer to that. I suspect that there are historical forces that I don't think I can address. But I do think that the question of organization has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. What happened after the defeat of Goldwater in 1964 was that young extreme right-wingers decided that they had to start organizing. And the right began organizing. I would say in the early 1980s, huge numbers of people on the left decided that organizing membership organizations, mass organizations, was no longer important. What you wanted to do was to relate to the media. And we began to see the evaporation of left organizations. At the same time, what we saw was the rise of right-wing mass organizations. I think that is the question of whether you put attention into organizing people, forming organizations, bringing people into the left on an active basis, not just as audience, is at least part of the answer. I don't think it's the whole answer.
I agree with both points that were raised, which is obvious that we're a love-in at this point. First, my point about race, settlerism, and empire was to really situate the dilemma that we face here. I agree with what Michael was raising, and I also feel fundamentally the facts don't speak for themselves anywhere. People speak. And I think that what you were raising about Rush Limbaugh and others is absolutely correct. But again, I think that their narrative in many ways corresponds to what people wish to believe about the United States. They don't want to believe, for example, that we helped to annihilate 3 million Indonesians. They simply don't want to believe it. So you don't, right? But I agree with your basic point. Now, in terms of what Barbara was raising, if you look at the 60s, part of what helped to make a left here was a vibrant anti-racist struggle initiated first by the Black Freedom Movement, but then cascaded to other movements, and then went beyond race, that laid the foundation for a mass left. The other piece that happened was global anti-imperialism, that we had, you know, in the period after World War II, the rise of national liberation struggles, and it was like every day that a domino was falling. And this also contributed to this kind of mass leftism that we saw here. So I think that in addition to this issue of organization. But one thing about your point about the right, the way I would interpret what the right did after Goldwater was slightly different from what you said. The right was organized before Goldwater, but they were organized in a very particular way. They were organized along the lines of white citizens' councils, the Minutemen, the original Minutemen, and I don't mean Paul Revere's people, but you know, there were groups like that. After 64, you can talk about a sort of post-64, post-civil rights right wing that begins single issue movements that go beyond race, anti-abortion, gun control, etc., where they recognize that there needed to be a way of creating a mass right that went beyond simply being identified with a George Wallace or a Bull Connor. And I think that was one of the masterful things that they did, in addition to creating think tanks, because they recognized that there needed to be their version of theory, but more importantly, propaganda and the creation of echo chambers that helped to supplement the organizing that they did on the ground. So it's just a slightly different take on what you were laying out.
Thank you, Bill. And we'll move on to the next and final presenter before the final dialogue. But quickly, the intention for this type of panel and presentation was not so much to set up a debate where clashes would unfold between people who hold fundamentally different views, but rather take advantage of a situation where people come together face to face who share many common ideas and complementary agendas and care about building a left movement in this country and internationally. And so it was to take advantage of this and hopefully present a rich dialogue and something we can all chew on. So now finally, Michael Albert will do the final presentation.
I'd sort of like to talk about the 60s and the difference between that and now, but maybe for later for that. Before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the most recent U.S. invasion of Iraq, there were demonstrations around the world of about 3 million people. It was the most incredible thing. Rarely has there been a demonstration before a war to not have the war. This was the largest demonstration in history before a war to not have a war. In the Vietnam case, it was 7 years into the war before you could generate anything, much less before the war. Now, all these years later, it would be hard to generate tens of thousands of people demonstrating against the war. If we were team revolution or team peace, and we were all coaches, and we didn't have that question on our minds every day, how could that possibly have happened? How could we not grow, much less decline catastrophically, we'd get fired? But we don't, or a lot of people don't. And that's weird at some level, if we want to win. If we want to do something else, maybe it makes sense that we just ignore it because it's painful. But if we want to win, we'd pay attention to it. 2 years ago, Obama ran for president. I don't know the numbers. Thousands? Is it tens of thousands of people went door to door? talking to Americans, often to white Americans, about the idea of a black president. Not exactly something that you would anticipate being easy to do. Tens of thousands. How many people who are in favor of, you know, another alternative world is possible? How many people who are in favor of that alternative world would go into neighborhoods and talk door to door, or have anything to say door to door about the movement that we want to build? Once again, Team Revolution's coaches need to understand why one thing inspires activism, inspires commitment, inspires courage, and the other inspires long talks, but not that stuff. Why is that? Okay, so if we had asked Jesse last night, I think he would have said hope, no hope. That is to say, on one side, whether it was stopping the war before it started or whether it was trying to elect Obama, there was hope. There was an understanding that there was the possibility of success, that one could make contributions that would lead to success. But the other, there's no hope. There is no feeling that there is even a success to be had, much less an ability to contribute to success. Okay, but that doesn't answer, well, what's the basis for hope? Jesse said last night, you know, the suffragettes won the vote. They fought and they won. The abolitionists fought and won. The movement against Jim Crow fought and won. For that matter, the women's movement, starting again in the 60s, fought. It's not as if sexism is gone or racism is gone, but if you took somebody from the 1959 and you dropped them in the world today, they would be completely addled. Put them in a law school and have them see that half the population is women, and their minds would be blown. There have been tremendous gains because people fought and won because they had hope, because they knew what winning was. Okay, so the hypothesis that I want to offer is that the difference is that we don't know what winning is and we have no idea how to do it. But it's because we don't try. At the end of the thing last night, Jesse said, we've won every fight we've fought. We've never won a fight we haven't fought. This is another example of a sort of non-intellectual who is really an intellectual, right? A person who doesn't talk in big words, et cetera, but who has something profound to say. That is subtle and profound, and people should think about it. But what it would say to us is, we haven't really fought for the other world. That's what it would suggest, and I think that's true. I really do, and I know it might be hard, but I do think it's the case. So, I want to do an experiment. This is a bit out of my usual ballpark, because people have already said what I might have wanted to say, so instead I want to do an experiment. Imagine you were in a coma for the last 6 months. Each of you individually has been in a coma. You wake up, you're in the hospital, and there's somebody there with you who you trust. Somebody, maybe it's a relative, maybe it's a friend, but it's somebody who you trust and who you share a lot of values with. And the person says to you, you know, it's fantastic. In the last 6 months, there was an organization created. We're in the United States. You could do this anywhere you want. There was an organization created. And this organization now has chapters in lots of cities around the country. And it has membership. And this organization, I joined it. And I hope you're going to join it. And the person who is in the coma, this is you. Now, I don't know. Some of you may have to stretch to feel this way. Some of you, it might be automatic. You're excited. I mean that sincerely. I think for a lot of people, it's a stretch to feel like they would be excited that they want to hear about it, okay? But make believe. Imagine you're excited. Imagine that, and why should you be excited? If we're going to win, that has to happen. This is supposed to be the path to a better world. Well, someplace on that path, we're going to have organizations which are massive, which involve people, which people own, which people create the strategy for, which people self-manage, and on and on. So the person is all excited and says to you, this organization was formed. And then they say to you some things. I won't go into too much detail, but they might say something like, the organization is anti-capitalist. Please raise your hands. I know this is outrageous, but please raise your hands. Come on, get your hands up. Raise your hands. It's possible to participate. drop your hand when I say something that would cause you, you just got out of this coma, to feel, you know what, I don't want to join that organization. Okay? I'm going to list some things. If I say something that causes you to not want to join the organization, drop your hand. But keep it up otherwise. Okay, the organization is anti-capitalist. The organization is anti-racist. The organization is anti-sexist. The organization is anti-authoritarian. Okay, everybody's hands still up. It's interesting. The organization treats those domains of life, kinship, politics, economics, culture, and it doesn't prioritize one among the rest as its logic and its philosophy, but rather it assumes that they're all entwined and that addressing all of them is paramount and critical and that this organization is going to do that. Hands dropping? No. This organization is fighting for a world in which there is no longer hierarchies inside those various domains of life that cause some people to be systematically robbed of the same benefits that other people accrue, much less most people being obliterated, which is what we live with. So that means that this organization is about creating a world in which there is no longer a gender hierarchy, a sexual hierarchy, a racial hierarchy, a hierarchy around beliefs in culture, religious and ethnic, a hierarchy of class, any kind of class hierarchy. No hands dropping. Okay, this organization then tries to describe institutional features. A big list? No. A minimalist list. The basic key features that would have to be had, and beyond that, there's tremendous room for variety and discussion and debate, but some basic features which, if we didn't have them, then we wouldn't have a world of the type that we want. And it describes those, and I won't do it because I don't think I have time, and I want to move on to discussion. I mean, I've done it a lot for some areas, huh?
Just over 10 minutes.
Yeah. What?
Hands are tired.
What did they say?
Hands are tired. They want to join so bad.
Oh, the hands are tired. Okay, do it the opposite way. You can put your hands down. You can raise them at the end. So, for example, regarding the economy, which I've spent a lot of time thinking about, how do you answer the question, what do you want for the economy? Which I think if we can't answer that question, we're not in the game. We're not trying to create a new world if we have no answer at all. So if we don't want classes, then we don't want private ownership of the means of production. So this organization says none of that. We're not going to get rid of it tomorrow, but we're for a world in which you can't own workplaces and factories and have wage slaves. We want a world in which also it's the case that the economy's relationships don't cause some people to have lots of power and other people to have none, to obey orders. Some people to have circumstances which are empowering and enriching, and other people to have circumstances which are debilitating and repetitive and so on. So we need to, this organization is about changing the division of labor. This organization is about achieving equity of income. So we're gonna have a world in which you don't get income for owning property. You don't get income for being powerful and taking it. You don't get income because you were lucky and born more productive, or you happen to be working in an area where you produce more. Rather, you get income for how long you work, for how hard you work, and for the onerousness of the conditions under which you work, period, as long as you're doing socially valuable labor. Okay, something like that. Don't bother getting into the nitty-gritty of that. Assume for a minute, this is an experiment, assume for a minute that your friend, who's woken you up from your coma, says, this is what this organization is for. This is the minimal list of structures around kinship, around culture, in the political sphere, in the economy, which will at least provide the basis for real liberation. And you like it. Suppose you agree, those are nice features. All right? And then the person goes into the organizational structure and talks about how it has to welcome dissent, how it has to even foster dissent internally, how it has to have internal mechanisms for people to dissent, how it has to have mechanisms that allow dissenting views to experiment so that they aren't sublimated. And in other words, more and more features that you like. And the question is, do you join? Do you join? And I suspect the answer in the country right now among anti-capitalist leftists is no for many. And it's there's no point in trying for many. It's hopeless. People will fight. People will argue. People will kill each other, et cetera, et cetera, for many. And to me, our problem is not the 16th decimal point of exploitation, or even the second decimal point, or even the nearest thousand. Our problem is this stuff, is somehow, what is it inside us, that internal problem that you're talking about, what is it about our beliefs or our commitments or our habits which causes us to be less courageous, less energetic, less inspired than those people who are working for Obama? Less energetic, less creative, less than the suffragettes and the, you know, the anti the civil rights movement or the abolition movement or in, you know, the ANC, the movement in South Africa recently. What is it that's beating us internally? I once had a discussion with somebody who said, "Oh, Michael, you're crazy. The public is, you know, they believe in the country and everything else." I said, "How many people believe Bush knocked down the World Trade Center?" Estimates are that it's 30 or 40% of the population. 30 or 40% of the population believes that that Bush knocked down the World Trade Center. Okay, now it's ludicrous, but the point is that it isn't as if everybody believes we live in a... Okay, and let me just say one thing about the difference between the 60s and now. In the 60s, we didn't think that prior presidents knocked down the Trade Center. We thought this was a good country. This was a just country. That I'm talking about myself. I thought, you know, it's fair. It's just. People care. Corporations try to help people. Lawyers try to produce law. Doctors try to produce health. And we went fucking berserk when the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement, first the Civil Rights Movement, then the Vietnam War, said, it's not true. And then convinced us, holy crap, it is completely and totally false. And we got pissed and angry, really angry. And we didn't need a vision. We didn't need, in order to get angry, we were just furious. It's like me lying to you. You get furious or something. We are furious. We didn't need a vision. We didn't. But nowadays, you can't say anything to anybody in the United States about American behavior which will shock them. It's impossible. You, the left does not say things that are as bad as what you find in popular culture. You cannot shock people. So in other words, what you could organize with then, which was in a sense the list that you're talking about, right? In other words, and the evidence that it was a heinous crime or a systematic abuse of the population, that made us furious. Nowadays, that just gets a yawn because people know that it's the case. And so in the absence of the belief in the alternative, and just saying another world is possible isn't going to convince anybody. It's become a mantra, everybody says it. Well, you know, good God, if we're really serious, 2 seconds after we said it, we should have said, well, here's what it looks like. And if we can't say what it looks like at a minimal level, then we can't talk about it yet. Okay, so we do that. Does the absence of this explain anything else? I think it does. Why do we beat each other up? It's because we can't beat anybody else up. I mean, at some real level. In other words, the other side is so big, and we don't believe we can get any place, so we beat each other up about nonsense. Why do we fragment and split? Because the only thing that matters is our damn personal identity. So, you know, we construct what we consider to be the perfect identity when we look at ourselves in the mirror, but we don't try to win. I mean, if you go to Venezuela tomorrow, you're not going to find that people in Venezuela are nitpicking about nonsense in the left, because they think they're doing something. When you don't think you're doing anything, you start to infight, and you start to focus on things like, you know, minute differences, and you take every difference, every criticism as a personal attack instead of as a step to try to create something better. Anyway, I think that that the obstacle to winning is us. I don't think winning is impossible. I really don't. I think what Jesse said last night is right, that the other side is ultimately not the problem, that the media and the tanks and the police is ultimately not the problem. Ultimately, the problem is whether we fight well. Ultimately, the problem is whether we fight hard. And ultimately, the problem is whether we can communicate with the population in a manner which causes them to fight as well. It has to be that that's the problem. Maybe this is just Pollyanna-ish, but if that's not the problem and the other stuff is the problem, we're fucked, right? But that is the problem. The problem is us, and it is correctable. What drives me crazy is that we don't try to correct it. We don't say it. We don't get up each night feeling, God damn, how are we going to change the fact that we went from 3 million down to tens of thousands? That's the thing to come, get up thinking about, not, some contract point in the World Bank or something. I'm not saying that stuff's unimportant, but it's been done to death. Everybody knows imperialism sucks. We don't have to prove it. What we have to do is convince people that an alternative is viable, worthy, not just worthy, but vastly superior, that it would work, that it would meet people's needs, that it will fulfill people, and that we can do things which are not rolling rocks up a hill only to get crushed when they come back down. That we can, with our difficult circumstances, do stuff that will contribute to the process. One last minor point. An external thing, internal and external. I think there is an external thing that has been disastrous for us, but it's different from, it's the amount of time that people work. It's the amount, in other words, something that has happened between the 60s and now, among all the things that has happened, one thing that has happened is, and a number of people here are talking about it in terms of the economy. You know, you want to consume, you have to consume, so you get the second job, you do this, you do that, and the amount of time that's available to think, to act, to do either, keeps dropping. If that's true, and if that's a big impediment on top of all these other impediments, then it suggests that one of the things that a program of the left ought to address is time, is giving people more time. Because if people don't have more time, there's no way that they can do anything. So one of the things that we need to win is, you know, there's a million ways to say it, 30 hours work for 40 hours pay. Or 30 hours work for 45 hours pay, except for those who are earning more than $100,000, in which it's 30 hours work for 10 hours pay. In other words, redistribute the wealth. You can do a million things with this demand. But one thing that you can do is free up time so that if we ever learn how to talk in a way that conveys a vision and a strategy and therefore makes real the entreaty, it doesn't continue to be the case that if we piled on facts, Bill, like your facts, if we piled on facts about how bad cancer is, nobody would join us in a movement against cancer. It doesn't matter. We'd be right. We'd be eloquent. We'd be moving. We'd be compelling. And nobody would join us because a movement against cancer is nonsense. If we pile on facts about capitalism, it's the same thing. Because in the end, they feel like capitalism is like cancer. It's just part of reality. And if anybody is going to solve any part of it, it's going to be some scientist in some lab someplace. You know, it's not going to be us. And that is the thing that needs to be overcome. Because, again, we win every fight that we fight, or we win every battle that we fight, but we never win a battle that we don't fight. I think Jesse's right. Thanks.
Okay. Well, as you have all come to expect, I agree with everything Michael said. But, and I want to add a few things to some of his points, which I think are really important. But I also want to add something, which I think is missing there. I really agree about the issue of time. I myself would settle for the 8-hour day. I haven't seen an 8-hour day in decades. Yeah. And it definitely gets in the way of building community and organizing. I also agree that the media and the police and the tanks are not the problem, and we should stop blaming them. And I think that we absolutely have to have a vision, a very clear vision of a better society, and I agree with Michael's vision. The thing that I would add, though, is that I think in order to have a mass movement, you can't do it just on the basis of a vision of a better society. You've got to have a focus that addresses people's immediate situations in their daily lives, and preferably in a way that they feel forced to address. That's what we had in the 1960s, both around the issue of racism and around the issue of the war, and in particular the fact that there was a draft. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should come out in favor of a draft, but the fact that there is no draft reinforces the point that Bill was making, that it's possible for everybody to ignore the endless succession of wars that the United States is involved in. I think I made a mistake in my talk when I talked about strategy and I left out the war. I think what we have to point out, I think we have a difficult job. I think we have to point out to people that the economic and social problems that they face, the destruction of social services in this country, is connected to endless wars, because it's the wars that are sucking up all the money. And I don't know if we can do it. See, I think that our job is more difficult now than it was in the 1960s. But I do think that in order to organize that kind of movement, even to mobilize the enthusiasm of people who understand themselves as leftists, you do have to have that kind of focus that brings it down to the here and now and poses it in terms of issues that people feel they have to address because they're rooted in their daily lives.
Well, I agree with what Michael was raising. I think that there's a problem of I think this builds on what Barbara was saying, problem of a program versus a problem of strategy. You know, decades ago, when I read the points that Lenin proposed for admission into the Communist International, I said, okay. And, you know, I mean, they didn't seem particularly wild for a radical organization, but the issue was in the detail. The issue was at the level of strategy. It wasn't simply what the program was or the basic platform. What was this thing actually going to do? Yeah. And how was it going to play out in the real world? And I think that's where a lot of this unfolds. But the other thing I just wanted to flag some additional problems that I think we have to confront head on. One thing that Barbara mentioned before is NGOism. The idea that one has to be paid for political work. And this is not just true among younger activists who are in nonprofits. You can see it often in the labor movement and other sectors where there is this expectation that if I'm going to do political work, I must get paid. If I'm not getting paid, I'm not doing political work. And this is something that I think we're going to have to deal with head on. A second thing, there's a problem that it overlaps with the issue of postmodernism, the problem of people falling into, I want to organize around a struggle where I'm feeling comfortable, right? The people that I like or a struggle that I can embrace, but I really don't want to go outside of those parameters. A third thing is what Jesse was mentioning last night, and I'd say the notion of a long march. And this is where the issue of organization, radical left organization, becomes very important. That in the buildup to the Iraq War, just as in the Obama campaign, there was an exaggeration of the possibility of victory. And by that I mean that there was an overexpectation that with millions of people, we were going to stop the war, rather than recognizing that ruling classes can start wars very easily and over massive opposition. Think about World War I. They do it by pulling the trigger and by embracing people in patriotism, right-wing patriotism. And this is where you needed a left that basically is saying, yes, we have to take all of these steps to try to stop the war, but we have to realize that it's going to be difficult, the war will probably start, and we're going to have to continue. With Obama, the exaggeration of expectations about what was going to happen after he won was not mitigated by a left that was saying, after he wins, we have to stay on him like white on rice. We have to force him to do things that he's not going to otherwise do. Instead, there was this expectation among millions of people that we simply elect the guy and then he will do the right thing, whatever that happens to be. Final thing, Michael was mentioning the movement against cancer. And I think actually there is a very important lesson here. There has been a very successful movement against cancer. No, we haven't cured cancer. But one of the things that's important is that it's not been simply providing people with facts about the danger, but that there are things that people can do. That you can stop smoking. That when you're in a workplace with certain kinds of chemicals, there's struggles that you can engage in to get rid of those chemicals that lessen your chance. Right? It doesn't mean that we've resolved the problem, but it says that there is actually hope, that getting cancer is not necessarily a death sentence, whereas 30 or 40 years ago, for all intents and purposes, it was. Again, the facts never speak for themselves. People speak, we create narratives, and we give people hope, but the hope is always based in strategy.
Okay. I'm trying to find something to differ about. And obviously, program is of fundamental importance, but program is had by an organization, so you have to talk about what an organization is before you talk about program. That is the only reason. And I do think the time thing could be a first key. I could see that as an international demand. I mean, yeah. You know, just an international demand. The same thing, you know, media is part of the problem. It's just that it's not our problem. It's the problem of the system. So I could also see, just like the anti-corporate globalization movement, a movement around media, except now there are targets everywhere. So a worldwide campaign about media actually covering reality, et cetera, would be another programmatic thing that would be really... Okay, so... But something we could disagree about. I think I disagree about the draft. And it's not that I don't think, of course, a movement should address real things. I don't know whether it's right to do this, but Jesse last night, in response to something to one of the questions put to him, and the question, I can't do this perfectly, but the question sort of said, well, there's no substantive gain in that healthcare proposal. And Jesse's reaction, I mean, he tried to, I think, rein in the anger that he felt, and I think the anger was justified, and what he reacted was, you know, millions of people getting health care who didn't have it before is substance. And the left often doesn't understand that. The left often thinks that the only substance is revolution, is everything changing, and that isn't substance. So program is about meeting needs and doing it, but doing it in a way that leads you further instead of being a dead end. Okay. But the draft, I mean, I can only tell you when I was there, and I did do some draft organizing, and we did, you know, house AWOL soldiers and everything else, and we certainly did organizing on campuses. I don't think it's what galvanized the movement. Partly for a bad reason. The movement, especially at a certain point in time when it was big, was very much a privileged sector of people who could easily get out of the draft. It was trivial to get out of the draft. We all did it, and nobody had any trouble doing it. The people who were more courageous went in and organized. But it wasn't... People opposed the war because it was heinous, because it was immoral, because they started to identify with the people whose heads were getting blown off in Vietnam. That's why, at least that's why I, you know, and that's not impossible. It is possible to have that. Now, I don't want to have that taken to be, okay, we should just be about the, you know, the worst off people in the world, and we should, no, of course not. The people here have needs and have programs, and programs should address it, so. But the same thing goes because, and here it's stronger, for war because it costs too much. I don't think we should ever oppose war on grounds that it costs too much. The reason is because if a war is just, it doesn't cost too much. You know, if people believe it's just, then they don't believe that it costs too much. Right. So if all you say about a war is it's taking money that could go for this or that or the other thing, it is not addressing the problem, which is that they believe it's just, or they don't believe it's unjust, or they don't believe you can do anything about it, in which case you're not talking to them. So that doesn't mean you don't talk about the cost of the war, okay, because it's important, and because you have to move the resources. Okay. So there we... Then the Long March thing, I do think that's fundamental, absolutely fundamental. I mean, an example from the 60s was May Day. You remember the May Day demonstrations went to Washington. The slogan was, you know, if the government doesn't stop the war, we're going to stop the government. So we'll shut down the government. And indeed, we went to Washington, thousands of people shut down the city of Washington for a few hours, maybe a day. And then the next day, the war was still going. If the government doesn't, and the way of organizing was, we'll end the war tomorrow. You know, we'll end the war on Sunday, we'll come home and it'll be ended. Now, Rennie Davis and Tom Hayden weren't confused, right? They knew that the war wasn't going to end, right? But they organized that way because they felt that they could build momentum that way, which was true. They could build momentum that way, but it was worthless momentum because it wasn't momentum that would be sustainable. And that's what I think you're saying, that... And so somehow we have to change what's cool at some level. I don't know how to put this. We have to. It's cool now to be momentarily angry. It's cool to be more angry than the next person. It's cool to use a tactic that's more radical than the next person. That shouldn't be cool. That shouldn't be a benchmark of anything. It either makes sense or it doesn't. What should be cool is to be in the Long March. That's what ought to be cool. That's what ought to be respected. That's what ought to mark somebody as having done. And I don't know how you do that, but that change, too, would have an incredible effect on how we conduct ourselves. But how do you do it? I don't know. Anyway.